In a time where social justice organizations are under attack, we bring you Rad Ops. That stands for Radical Operations. It's a dialogue-based tool that supports organizations assessing and discussing the possibilities and limitations of putting liberatory values into practice.
Many organizations are in turmoil as they pivot to meet this moment. RadOps offers principles, guiding questions, and tools that organizations can use to identify ways that they can and cannot practice liberatory values in this unjust world.
I'm one of your co-hosts, Yeshna Maya Padamsi.
And I'm your other co-host, Shad Grogan Brown. Together, we bring over 40 years of movement operations experience to inform these conversations. Our topic for this episode is non-compliance in an unjust world. And we want to be clear from the start, especially in this episode, that we are not lawyers and nothing we talk about is legal advice, but the dialogue that we're offering on this topic should be discussed among your team. And you might also want to consider getting legal counsel or at least discussing it with your peer organizations if you want to try something that we talk about, but you worry it might put your organization or your work or your people at risk in a way that you might not be equipped to manage. So we trust y'all listeners to make grounded decisions based on the reality of your organization, and it just feels especially worth saying that for this episode.
Our guest today is Roberto Tijerina, who is a queer Latino first-generation child of immigrants, organizer, and keeper of the heart space. Since becoming politicized in his early adolescence, Roberto has worked as an organizer, connecting his queer, immigrant, multilingual experience to broader racial, economic, and gender justice movements. His experience includes working for Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund, Highlander Research and Education Center, the Audre Lorde Project, and Southerners on New Ground, or SONG, which is where we met. Learning at the feet of many and by doing the work, he has helped develop a language justice framework and lens that are informing current movement work. His political North Star has always been the question, are you willing to be transformed in the service of the work? Welcome.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here with y'all.
We're so happy to have you.
Yeah. Welcome. Welcome, Beto. We are so grateful that you accepted the invitation, and we're really excited to talk to you about this topic. And I know it's very live for a lot of folks out there. Non-compliance in an unjust world. And we know you've also worked with so many organizations in our movement on an array of areas, from language justice, which is how we met, to finance and administration, and a lot of other areas, and all with a really deep, grounded political leadership. And I've been blessed to work with you on various projects over the years, and you are, in fact, one of my RadOps lineages, with the mentorship and the training that you gave me all those years ago, and so many others around comprehensive approaches to language justice. So because we know you have this really grounded political approach to your work, before we get into all of our more detailed questions, and in the spirit of like no one size fits all, what kind of zoomed out framing would you offer to folks around non-compliance that you think are sort of fundamental, big picture things to think about before we tackle the zoomed in questions? And this is like stuff you might want to reference throughout our conversation.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. I think when we're on Team Justice, you know, one of my comrades, Mary Hook, says, you know, like, do you have your hand on the plow? So we're all moving toward the same thing. And I think sometimes it's easy to make assumptions that we are in agreement about everything, or that we even understand certain concepts and words the same way. So I think before getting into like nitty gritty around non-compliance, I think about when I work with organizations, some of the fundamental questions that I ask at the beginning is there clarity around the organizational mission? And is there agreement around the organizational mission? And I say that because I work with organizations that run the gamut, the progressive gamut from what in shorthand I would say mainstream and radical. And even there's not agreement about what those mean. And so for some, their mission is actually in contradiction with even the concept of noncompliance. So one, do you understand your organizational mission? And do you agree with it? Does everyone on the team agree with it? That's one. And then what is the orientation towards noncompliance? And that's a really important one because every person that's part of the team or the formation has to know where they are in terms of like noncompliance. And then where is the organization in terms of like noncompliance? And if they're not in agreement, what are the decisions being made? Like, I may not agree with this, but I agree with the work of this organization and this is how the organization's rolling. So I'm willing to take this risk, or this is not a risk that I'm like willing to take. And then probably the most important part is like the due diligence. And that's like, before rolling into it, have you researched different methods to like, what's the goal of the noncompliance? And is this one way the only way to achieve the goal? So there's that one. Then have you done scenario planning? Have you gamed out like, what are the possible different outcomes if we move this way? And then have you done the work of safeguarding the organization? You know, whether that's financial reserves in case there's fallout, plausible deniability, and then also the buy-in. I don't think that it's principled to like put other folks at risk without their consent.
Yeah. And what I love about what you just shared also is I think lifts up what we're saying with the RADOPS framework, which is talk to each other, do this advanced preliminary work that as we're moving so quickly, it feels like we can't do, but it's so essential to do to set us up well to be able to move quickly. So thank you for that. So as you know, we are building a RADOPS lineages timeline. And you know this because you translated the from English into Spanish for our RADOPS workbook. So thank you so much for that work. And I love knowing that you're already part of this project. So since we're building this RADOPS lineages timeline, we're asking all of our guests, is there some person, organization, movement lineage that you want to name and honor who has shaped your RADOPS work? And also in that, tell us about yourself through that lineage and tell us what types of roles you've played and your own personal operations route and how you got into this work.
Thank you. I love this question because I think that lineage, naming the lineage is so important to be grounded in any particular moment. And that's just about honoring where one got skilled up, but it connects the thread. And that's, there's no replacing that. I would say that I had a life before movement. At that time I worked in the corporate sector, and I also worked like in the service sector. So I would say that I learned some of the very, very basics while like doing that work. When I came to a point in my life when I like left the church and started to get out into the bigger world, every step of the way, there has been someone who took the time to teach me what comes next. And when I first left the church, like my politicization, like most folks, developed over time. So when I first came out, I was working with a lot more mainstream orgs that were doing good work, but maybe didn't have a class or a race analysis. And I was also out newly gay. So everything, I was all the gay orgs, and I wasn't yet like, oh, are all gays created equal? But even in those, there were like a part of a lineage is, you know, not every lineage is perfect. Eventually, I when I think about my development, I think about before and after Highlander, which is what changed my life. I made the decision 20-something years ago to move to the South to learn and become steeped in Southern organizing, and Highlander was the first step in that. And I think that's where the seeds of my language justice work got started. Because when I went there, I was already a professional interpreter, but I had not yet married it to some of the bigger power plays. And then from there, I started meeting a chain of people. And what got me to, I want to specifically name when it comes to operations, I was hired to work at the Audre Lorde Project in 2013. And so I specifically want to name Chris Hayashi, who was the co-director at the time that I was hired, and Kara Page, who was the incoming director, not co-directors. And they both, that was when like really, I had never worked at that level of ops. And ALP had not just foundation grants, but city grants and state grants and like all this stuff that was like really new to me and like really cumbersome. And that was the first time that I really felt like I was delving into QuickBooks in a way that not only was I pulling it apart, but I was starting to understand the things like why budget was, as a person that was responsible to reporting to the board every month what the financials were, and because of their political generosity and their expertise, the learning as I went was a lot smoother than it could have been.
Thank you so much for sharing. And it's so beautiful to hear about your journey. And I know there's so many more pockets that we don't know, but I'm really glad to root into your path.
Yeah. And as lineages come, there may be others that emerge throughout our conversation. So bring the folks and the movements in as you feel them here. So I guess we'll pivot a little bit in here to talking about the RadOps principles. And for folks who haven't looked at it yet, we have a RadOps workbook. You can find the link in the story, in the show notes. But we're trying to ask each of our guests to tell us about sort of which of these RadOps principles resonates for you or has been a guiding force for you in your approach, particularly to operations work. And then within that, if you can tell us a couple examples of how you've seen people put a RadOps principle into practice, and in particular around this topic of non-compliance.
Well, the real answer is all of them, because I use them all and they're all good. So first I want to say thank you to all the minds and labor that were involved in helping to come up and with refining those. When forced to pick one for today's episode, I went with approach conflict with curiosity. That, I think, speaks to what is our posture and our orientation. The nature of operations work is full of contradictions, and it's full, sometimes just full of like disappointments, because oftentimes we can't operationalize the ideal that we want to for a lot of like different reasons. And that brings not just ideals into conflict, but humans into conflict. And you know, all the things that we bring as humans, you know, our joys as well as our traumas and our hurts. And so then we find ourselves in this space. And to me, the ethos of do approach it with curiosity then informs the posture of, which I always try to ask myself, is like, here, are you trying to win and be right? Or are you trying to build and move work? Because there's a difference, and one requires an openness and a humility. And it starts by like, okay, someone's bringing a different point of view or maybe even a very direct pushback to something that I'm like have put forward. And that to me is the difference of whether I like feeling it in my chest or whether I'm like, okay, like what's the point here? Like, what do I have the humility? So like, what did I miss? You know, like this comrade is bringing it like that, right? So obviously there's something of import there. So, and sometimes it changes your mind and sometimes it doesn't, but that won't happen if there isn't that humility. And, you know, and it goes back to like, are you willing to be transformed in the service of the work? Instead of very specific, like, I think I've seen that play out in so many things. It's played out when organizations are in disagreement about what their political strategy is. Mm-hmm. Should they be doing one campaign over another? Or when membership is like, are we an organizing shop or are we an incubator? Or when, you know, it's like my supervisor is acting in this way and they're, you know, they're being like very capitalist, which is like, no, this person is just like not really working to the level that I'd like. There's so many things where I think this question of, do I have the curiosity to find out what's going on in the service to comrades and the work?
I love that. And it's right, speaks to the heart of why we included that principle, because we really, like Yeshna said before, like this project is an invitation to talk to each other, and especially when there's conflict, actually, and to, yeah, be open anyway to the things you said. So thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. And I love that you brought it back to your North Star question. Are you willing to be transformed in the service of the work? And I think that's a question we can ask with any of the principles, and a question that, as you shared your lineages, shows that you're practiced in that North Star too, of like changing each time a new movement calling came to you. So Thank you for that. Another question for you. So if you had to name an operations topic of conversation that gets the most airtime, what would it be? In other words, what do you think are the most live question movement operations folks you're in touch with are grappling with right now?
The conversation that I seem to find myself the most in is kind of goes to like the heart of what y'all's project is, which is the real impacts of the contradictions of working in the C3 structure. Like that's, and sometimes it's like, it has to do with benefits, or sometimes it has to do with HR policies, or like the things that impact like people's like real lives. And right now, all like the conversations, and I don't know if y'all have clocked this, but I feel like we're like in a moment where movement is going through it and organizations are going through it. And the external political conditions are already exerting so much pressure. And even since the beginning of this administration, organizations have kind of folded. And along with that, there's like this, there's internal stuff that's happening outside of the external threats that organizations are always going through it. And more, and a lot of the conversations are around this thing that the organization is being unjust. Like, I feel a lot of conversations like our organization is not living up to its values of X, Y, Z. And I'm not saying, and you know, there's validity in all things, right? Like folks are like bringing something up, and because we're trying to do this liberation work in an imperfect system, undoubtedly organizations are making decisions that are like not the most just, and all the contradictions in the country. So I would say that's the top thing right now. And oftentimes beyond the like executive leadership, whatever that formation is, the crux of that conversation falls on the operations folks, because they're the ones that are executing the whatever the policies or the decisions are. Right. And often, so what I see a lot also is that much like interpreters, operation folks are often like the buffers for the frustrations on both sides, you know, and different operation folks are positioned differently in terms of like level of decision making or authority. So, yeah, it's pretty live.
Yeah, thank you for naming that really challenging thing. And I echo that. That's something that I've been hearing a lot too. And I think you're right that operations folks are positioned, whether or not they have positional power, they're positioned to be able to see a view of the organization that maybe other roles don't, and have their hands in multiple areas of the organization. So going back to what you named at the beginning of, can we get aligned, not just about organizational mission and strategy, but aligned about which values we are uplifting, carrying forward to the fullest extent, or at least to a portion extent, but just having those conversations. So then when it gets down to the tough moments, you know where the alignment is or where it isn't. So thank you for that.
Yeah, and I would say that when things get heated, it's easy to fall into the binary thinking. Like, even if we're like folks that like, when it's something that's, it's really easy for that focus to narrow. I won't get as deep, but another thing that's really kind of popping right now is all things tech. And, you know, as the world continues to become more tech digitized, all the things, there's conversations, tech vis-a-vis security, tech vis-a-vis media presence, tech vis-a-vis the use of AI, like all things tech.
That is such a big question. And I feel like that's my question. That's one of the things that I keep bringing up, being like, I don't know much about this. Who can we go to start to be in the grappling conversations?
Well, and I just to jump in here, I also think it is what you said around like the buffer that operations people often are, both between like systems and people, but also between our organizations and the state, or between the state and our people, that, you know, that they're, and it essentially also means then a lot of the operations folks are like the ones that are kind of testing, like, which edges can we push against and which ones are like, our values would say push, blow way past this particular edge. But when we really look at what risks the organization is in a position to take, we gotta not push past this one, even if we completely disagree with the thing we have to do. And it's that like calculation, you know, that is really challenging and emotional and is part of why I'm so grateful we're going into this idea of noncompliance, because I also think this is where we get to be creative in our thinking and our strategizing as operations people in how we're going to run our organizations, even under these conditions, in as liberatory ways as are possible at the given moment with the given conditions. And there's tons of legacies, speaking of lineages that we can draw from, a sort of like strategic noncompliance with unjust orders, right? From our folks, from our movement, from our communities, like whistleblowers or war resistors or slavery abolitionists or civil rights organizing, like sit-ins to fight anti-Black racism. There's so many legacies that we can draw from, and then we can fall into the kind of like, oh, but the law says this, and or anyway, there's so, but also in this time, like as you were referencing too, like this particular moment with the threat of fascism and rising fascism, it's also layering on top of that and instilling sort of this like fear into the mass public as a way to pressure us to comply in advance on our own in order to not face whatever they're threatening us with. And so on that note, I want to ask you to talk a little bit more about like a time when you and whoever you were working with had like a vision for doing your work in a values aligned way, but you came up against a constraint or a barrier from the state or from a legal structure or from funding restrictions. And if you can talk a little bit about, and I know you have a lot of examples of this, you know, like how are people figuring out how to push the edges of those barriers or not? And then like, how do you decide, you know, what do you comply with and where do you get creative?
The one that comes to mind, because it was way back when, but it's happening now in a different iteration, is, and it's also a bread and butter issue because it's so core, is employment. It's, you know, folks need to work to make money to pay their bills. And a lot of our folks don't have access to the traditional job market. I want to start by talking like back in the early to mid 2000s, like in 2003-04, when those spontaneous uprisings, like in major cities across the country, which was inspiring, and then the backlash that came. So what resulted with that was like the Sensenbrenner bill. Then that's where like the driver's license thing also like kicked up. That's when we got the introduction of like E-Verify. So like all these things. And I remember being at Highlander at the time, and we were developing the language justice curriculum. And one of the political underpinnings of that curriculum was that there's this whole generation of bilingual, highly skilled folks in the South who could be working as interpreters. And interpretation is one of those jobs that, if needed, like you can get paid under the table, like folks can like do this kind of job. And so that was a goal. And it was also a moment, I want to name the context. At that time in the South, almost every state immigrant rights organization was being led by like a white citizen, US citizen person, you know? And I think that we saw the beginning of a push against that with the principle that like folks most impacted should be leading the work. And some of the folks most leading the work had a lot of barriers to be able to work like in a traditional organization that required a W-2 and all the things. So there was a lot of like, all right, how do we get around that? And, you know, there were different strategies depending on the context. If some folks had a tax identification number to track like their earnings, then organizations would made the decision to hire them as like 1099 contractors as opposed to like W-2 folks. Some organizations made the decision to hire folks as 1099 contractors, even if they didn't have an ITIN number, kind of thing. Some organizations hired intermediaries, like folks that had consulting, like LLCs or like their own consulting. There's a thread of this that is about, there's a level of risk and having conversations with folks about what level they're willing to take. Mm-hmm. And I think about that because in this time, there were some folks that had like their own consultants and they're like, you know what, charge it to me. I will pay them and let me worry about how this gets, like all the things, you know. And I don't know all the things, but you know what? I was like, bet. And also thank you for that. And also knowing that some folks, their LLC, you know, if you're LLC, you're a single mom, and that's how you're keeping a roof over your head, maybe that's not a risk that you want to take, or that you're not willing to take. I think it's like a series of conversations, of honest conversations with the organization. Like, have you done a risk assessment? Would you be willing to do this? And if you are, here are like folks that you can talk to that are kind of doing it, or here's a movement employment lawyer that might give you some ideas, kind of stuff. And if not the organization, then who are the other players in community that are kind of to do that? And the strategies worked then. This was pre-DACA. And so all these, you know, E-Verify and whatever was making things really dicey. Then, you know, DACA came. And now that we're in this political moment, there's a reverse, except this time folks are in a different kind of way in the system and easier to find. And so the need is still there. How do folks get paid for their work? And I think folks are still figuring it out. Like the second iteration of this administration is much different than the first. And so it's been a year. Folks are, and so I think we're in that place where like a lot of folks, you know, have some time left on their DACA or their employment authorization. So the conversations are like, how are we going to do this? I haven't seen things emerge, though I think that some of the strategies that were used last time are still very viable. Me, for example, if I have like a one-off job that I know is not going to be a repeat, then maybe I will subcontract with an interpreter or a translator and keep it under $600. Do you know what I'm saying? Because then they don't have to, and I don't have to. And it works, you know, like that. Those opportunities don't come by often, but, you know, you look for the opportunities, right? And for me, like, I'm always, like, looking for, everyone's on the hustle, but I think, like, when it's on me to like tap, like, oh, we need more folks, I'm trying to find the folks that maybe don't have as easy access to it.
Yeah, I love especially the like, you look for the opportunities.
Yeah.
I want to ask if you can say, Beto, for people who might not know what DACA is or what it stands for, like, can you say whatever short way you're able to say, what is DACA and what changed during that period that made it different?
Yes. I don't remember what all the letters are. I know it's like deferred action of, is it children? But I think it was introduced by former President Obama for folks. The narrative that was spun was for like young people that, you know, were here undocumented through no fault of their own, which is problematic in its own way, but whatever. But it was a way to give folks authorization to work, to be able to apply for like in-state tuition, like all the things that kind of come with being able to have a Social Security number. And I remember when that was rolling out, like in community, folks were like, real like, yes, we need this. We want to be able to work. We want to go to college. And folks were like, are you, you know, what are you thinking? You want to put yourself on your rate on their radar kind of thing? And I think that's what changed. All of a sudden there was an opportunity. And I think a lot of movement leaders now that are like mid to late 20s and older have been able to do things with their lives that maybe they wouldn't have been able to because of like that program. And also depending on what folks' current immigration status is, that's a thing. And it's scary because part of like the DACA is you have to have like check-ins at an interval, like at intervals. Mm-hmm. And folks are having to make really hard decisions. It's like, if you don't go, you're automatically like on the radar for not being compliant. But if you go, there's a risk with showing up and being present. So yeah. The stakes are high in a different kind of way.
Yeah, and a pretty steady discernment each time, I would bet. And yeah, DACA stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals.
Thank you so much for sharing all of that, Roberto. So you touched on this a little bit already around risk assessment. One tool that we're highlighting is the practice of making risk assessments versus fear assessments. And in this time, as you so well uplifted with your examples, it's crucial for us to develop that muscle and skill in assessing what risks we're taking. So can you say more, either with that example or other examples, how you're seeing folks making risk assessments around when to comply with something that goes against their liberatory values for the sake of safety or other reasons? Do you have examples that you're seeing folks and sectors you work with make grounded risk assessments, or ways you've seen the impact even of fear-based assessments?
One thing I'm seeing more is if there's an increase of like fear-based assessments. And I really appreciated episode 3 with Jay and that conversation of like how to be able to like make the difference. And no shade on that. I mean, we are living in perilous times in some ways, right? And there are consequences for courage. And fight for liberation, fear is probably one of the things that hinders it most, right? So I say that, I also say like, people make the choices they need to make based on their risk assessment. Once fear, where I'm seeing folks having a lot of conversation and making different kinds of decisions, which makes sense, is where the work intersects in the public sphere, right? Because that's where like folks are most exposed to whether risk or liability. And this looks different for different organizations. Some the conversation is around their verbiage, you know, like, do we take the word trans, or do we take the word Black, Brown, you know, people of color out of our mission statement, off our website? Do like we scrub that? And what folks decide are based on a lot of things, and not just fear. It's also based on like the kind of organization. So I've seen like some membership organizations actually take it to the membership, you know, and whatever their process is, whether it's a simple majority, like they go through their process and the membership decides like collectively, take it off, don't take it off kind of thing. Other organizations don't work in that way. And then they're making things like, well, the work that we do is enough under the radar that if we do, you know, that if we keep this there, it's not going to really like ping anybody. Nobody's really looking at us. Other folks are like, we're really high visibility. And then they're having conversations of like, okay, the high visibility, if they're doing the gaming out, the case scenario, in like, if we keep it, this could happen, this could happen, this could happen. If we don't keep it, this could happen, this could happen, this could happen. And it's always heartening to see when folks can like take a breath and not necessarily lean in toward the fear-based right away. And these, you know, some folks are like, if we keep this, like there's no guarantee that by taking it away, we're not going to be a target anyway, because our work is such high profile anyway. So and then there's also always the conversation about the soul of the organization, if you will. Like, does taking it away betray who we're saying that we are? Or is who we're saying that we are, or have we been clear that we're about the safety of our people at all costs? And these are just some of the mitigating factors and costs of like doing that work. So there's so many things. It just, I want to go back real quick to a few things ago. I appreciated the kind words that you said, Yashna, about like living into like the valleys, but I just like also like want to be clear. I have made some really bad decisions that have had some impactful consequences on myself, organizations, and like other people. And I've been sometimes I come with my chest too, right? And it takes me a while to go back to the question of am I being, and I want to say that because I think when we like talk about, when we talk about the decisions that folks are making in the face of risk, it's very easy to be like, well, liberation is clear. This is what you do. But, you know, one of the fundamental teachings of like language justice is like people make the decisions based on their risks, based on their reality, right? And that's one of the fundamental rights that we, like that's just like part of being human and human dignity, to be able to make those decisions for ourselves. So yes, verbiage, also going back to the tech thing, like whether to have bios or pics. And for me, like, you know, just because, you know, because of who I am and mostly because I'm gay, I'm always like, oh, let me go look up their pic on their website. These are cute. but more and more, like I see that folks either have like a short bio and they have illustrations or just no picture whatsoever. And a lot of organizations have just removed the who we are about us team section altogether, right? And then probably the public sphere where the most happens is public actions. And I think organizations now are having okay, is this action strategic enough? What's the point of this action? Is it strategic enough to warrant the risk of, and we see that a lot here in DC, where you could be on one side of the street and you'll be dealing with Metro Police and it's a local thing. But if you cross the street, now you're on federal property. And so I think that folks are being, when it comes to the public sphere, having these conversations about do we have a safety plan? Is this what's needed right now?
Thank you for all those examples. And thanks for your vulnerability and honesty and saying, hey, I've messed up too. And that it's not easy to live and work in our values along with our values. And it's hard work and we have to keep trying and keep making mistakes and then try again. That's part of the work. So thanks for being honest about that. I also really liked in what you were sharing, a balance between what you called the soul of an organization, but then also very much grounded in the roots and the earths of an organization. And in that, the soul is the mission, the values, our North Star, our ideals, and then we have to take it back to the earth and to the roots and talk with each other, talk with your tech team to say, does this make sense with the website? Because I know some websites are still traceable even if you take things down, right? Or you're saying, take it to the members to be like, would it help you feel more or less connected if we had our bios up? You know, if you are a new member, there's so many different factors to consider here. So there's the soul and then there's the earth of it too. So thanks for naming that.
And there's the, we can do a lot of risk assessment. We can make a decision and it can still be a mistake. And that I think is what we're also just living in. And I think to me then, and I love what you're saying too, it's how do we own that? How do we learn from it? Not let it stop us or break us apart, but keep going with the lessons from that mistake or that, you know, maybe there were no good options and we chose the one that we thought was the least bad, you know. And I loved also your example of the action, where I think it's also having somebody who knows which side of the street is which jurisdiction is also really the helpful information you can get in the risk assessment to know then what do we need to know so that in a moment we can decide, are we going to comply with that or not? And not knowing that you can't make that decision willingly, but having the conversations and having the folks that know the information about the context of where we are gives us more options to then be discerning and be intentional with. And I, you know, I'm just thinking back to when you and I talked about this RadOps last summer, you were also flagging there's sort of, you've seen a rise in people's collective anxiety in the past 12 months, and that anxiety is causing folks to show up in a certain way. And I'm just jumping over to this question here, just kind of ask you to say a little more about, how are you started touching on it, but how are you seeing that anxiety inform the decisions folks are making around compliance or non-compliance? And when are they making then creative solutions around the compliance?
Yes. Well, I think like I mentioned earlier, one of the ways that I'm seeing it show up is a lot more kind of leaning toward fear-based. And even leaning into fear-based doesn't look the same. Some is kind of batten the hatches, but some, and this is work I've had to do, the very first months of this administration on the boards that I, organizations where I have some governance, mine became very guard dog. Mine became very I want to talk to the finance director. I want to da 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 da. I want to see the audit. I want to da 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 da. Based on this ethos, it's if we go down, let's go down for our work, not for missing receipts, kind of thing. Yes. And so that's another way that it shows up. And I wasn't thinking of at that point. I I realize now I was like reacting. So I hadn't taken the step to be like, oh, this is fear-based as well. You think you're being all proactive, but it's fear-based, right? And some of these things are actually good, but browbeating the organization from your position as a board member is not helping to quell the anxiety. You know what I'm saying? You might be making them more anxious, kind of thing. So, I think that that's one of the ways that it shows up. And I think that even fear-based decisions come from like a good place. Like they come from like, we want to protect the organization. We want to protect our people. We want to protect our community. One thing that I have seen organizations do, and I have been grateful to be in spaces in, is the organizations that are taking a moment to breathe and do like grounding work. Like do the grounding work. And that can look different for organizations. That's like, you know what, staff, today we're going to talk about all the things that we're anxious about, you know, in this new political moment kind of thing. And just like put it, like name it, say it, show our vulnerability to each other. Like these. And I think that's really important for people in leadership, because I think in moments like this, like folks are looking toward leadership. That goes to a whole other conversation about formations, but folks are looking to folks in leadership, and folks in leadership, at least folks that like take it as a sacred trust, then also like feel this pressure of like, oh my God, I'm in leadership. What am I going to tell folks to not freak out? So I think it's important to have those groundings. And so you name them. And then you also do other things like, what are things, Dorothy Allison, 2 or 3 things I know to be true, right? Like, what are the things that are true for each of us as individuals? What do we know to be true about our people? What do we know to be true about our organization? Kind of thing. And then maybe a session that's like, what is my relationship to risk? What am I willing to do for myself, for the community, for the organization? Those things can be different. Because I think that doing that grounding then puts us in place to start having the conversations like, okay, are we going to hire undocumented folks as 1099s? Like, are we going to do this? Are we going to do that? So that to me, has been so fundamental to me personally and to the organizations that I'm involved with, either directly or just been working, you know, on a consultative level with. Just like, take the time to know who you are, where you are, and then start making your decisions from there.
And I know personally from how you manage anxiety, one way is you just say that, you let the worries come, you say them, and until you're a little bit desensitized to them. Because at a certain point, they can also just rule everything if you're like holding them inside, but just verbalizing, letting them be there, and then being like, okay, hi, anxiety, heard. Let's take a breath. Mm-hmm. What else is here? So like, these may be true, they may not be true. What's the risk now? But now we at least all know these are the worries here.
And to connect it back to something earlier, you know, we were talking about how organizations are growing, going through it. Like these moments where us, for who we are and our people and our communities under attack, the natural thing is to like be defensive of ourselves and our people. I think that these are the moments that most call us to be vulnerable. If with nobody else, amongst ourselves and our comrades in our organizations, because if safety, you know, like is built on like trust and like vulnerability. If we can't do that to our closest people or the people that we see 5 days a week or the people that we're out on the streets with shoulder to shoulder, what do we have to build from? You know, and so that's why I think some of the things that y'all are trying to get through in this work, like the part of operations that has to do with principled struggle, with political North Stars, with based in relationships, is critical. More so when we're under attack.
Okay, we're getting short on time, but I do have one more important question, Beto. It's a real simple one. How do we balance tending to saving the current structures that we have built with building out other options to expand our ability to do our work, even if our structures aren't under attack? How do we balance that tension?
I'll keep it succinct because it's a whole other episode. I think that this political moment actually offers an opportunity for us to ask the question if the organizations, formations that we have now are worth saving. And by that, I just mean organizations, formations are built of a specific time, place, condition. And I think it's a good time to be like, does this still work? Like, is this, whether it's a C3 model, like, or just anything, right? Does it work better as an LLC? Does it work better as a church? So taking advantage of the moment to see if it's still what's needed.
I definitely want to have lots more conversation with you about that. Maybe we're talking about a season 2 episode. We'll see. But okay, to close us out, we have our RadOps speed round. Take it away, Yashna.
Great. We're each going to ask you a question, and it's a speed round. So first thought, best thought. Let's go.
Okay.
Spreadsheets versus Post-its.
False binary, but I'll go with spreadsheets.
Notes. All right. Notes. Digital versus analog.
Analog. But I think that just goes to my age. Go ahead.
Okay. Three options this time. Text versus phone call versus voice notes.
Voice notes all day, every day. It's the best of both worlds.
That's right.
Receipts. Do you keep them or toss them?
I keep them just until things have been reconciled.
What a nice finance person.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Give us a shout out to an org or ops person you are loving right now.
I want to shout out Roadmap. Their organization, their formation just does amazing work. Lisa Weiner-Mahfouz, who's one of their principals, just comrade and brilliant for a long, long time. Tara Shoy Ellison, Bridget Rusin, Griffin Moore. I mean, I know they have a whole bunch, but these are folks that I've just been seeing do amazing work and have worked with.
What song do you put on to set the tone for a meeting or a session?
So different modality. I'm not a song person. I'm a scent person. So depending on what it is, it'll either be sage or it'll be Nagshampa or it'll be this really awesome lilac scented candle that I have. So that's how I try to set the space.
I love it. And then related, what is the soundtrack for your operations work?
Okay. So in English, it's what I call booty inspirational. So if you think of like Beyonce's Formation, if that were like a radio station, that kind of stuff. And in Spanish, it's what I call Señora Divorciada, which is a very specific, like, I've been through it, but I'm taking care of business and keeping my joy.
I love it.
Three words to describe the future of movement operations.
I will offer courageous, creative, and resilient.
And then last one wish you have for movement operations people in this moment.
Know your worth as operations people and hold it with humility and in service.
Thank you so much for being here. I wish we had so much more time with you.
Thank you.
This was delicious.
Yes. Yes.
We hope you enjoyed the show. You can subscribe and listen to more episodes wherever you find podcasts. Check out the additional resources from each episode in the show notes and take it all back to dialogue with your teams about building adaptable and values-aligned infrastructure. You'll also find links there to subscribe to the RadOps Substack, where you'll get the latest updates and resources.
This show is produced by Josh Elstro and published by Convergence Magazine. Design support from Kimmy David. Music by Tiger Cat, my amazing 10-year-old, with polish by Josh. And remember,
keep it rad, y'all.